what triggered this bizarre behavior.
Journey into the cold heart of Northern Darkness with Nordic Crimes.
That case became like a scene from a horror movie.
A new true crime documentary series that chilled the bone.
The hunger for killing is increasing in the course of these homicides.
Listen on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Nordic Crimes is a part of the Acast family.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hello, and welcome back to 1 Minute Remaining. My name is Jack Lawrence, the host and creator of this show. Today is part two, and the final part for now, of the story of Gerald Johnson, currently serving a life sentence for the death of 45-year-old Ida Taylor. Gerald hit Ida's car during a pursuit in which Gerald was running from police. It's a crime, he says, he's guilty of. However, he says that the prosecution fabricated a weapon in order to sentence him for felony murder. In our previous episode, we heard how Gerald says the day of the incident, he was pulled over by police. He says as he's pulled over, police would draw their weapons. He knew he had narcotics in the car and that being caught would mean prison time. So he makes a decision that would change his life and the life of many others forever. As he goes to drive through an intersection, he collides with Ida's vehicle. He would climb from the passenger window and attempts to run on foot. The police car catches up with him. One of the officers now takes chase on foot while the other remains in the car to cut him off. Realizing he's not going to get away on foot, he sees a vehicle. Inside, the driver, Shauna Cates, and her husband, Daniel Cates, are sitting at the lights. Gerald heads for the driver's seat where Mrs. Cates is sitting, opens up the door and sits on her lap. He attempts to drive the car, but it's a stick shift, so it stalls. Mr. Cates jumps out of the passenger side and then pulls his wife out the same way. Once out, Miss Cates reaches into the car to grab her purse and Gerald drives off. At the scene, sadly, Ida Taylor passes away from her injuries sustained from the crash. Gerald would lay low for a couple of days, but after a call from his grandmother to say police had raided her house looking for him, he turns himself into police, where he's officially charged. Gerald says this is when he discovers not only that Miss Taylor has passed away, but also that prosecutors were charging him with felony murder because he had a firearm. It's a firearm, he says, he never had. So did you have was it a public defender that you took with you to the police station, or was it a paid attorney?
Now watch this, Jack. I had a lawyer named Johnny Price. He ain't never done a murder trial. He had never done a murder trial. I didn't know this. So I paid him $11,000, you know, and he got disbarred. I got found guilty in trial in 2002. No, I was sentenced in 2002. And he got disbarred in 2005. I say that because when I got his paperwork about why he got disbarred from the Office Disciplinary Committee, they sent me out his paperwork, was because he was an incompetent lawyer. He would be late for trial. He wouldn't go talk to witnesses. He was some of the same things that I was saying at the end of my trial when the judge said, is there anything that you would like to say? Was your lawyer fair and all that? And it's crazy because so many things has happened. My case is kind of a weird, odd case, Jack, and you're hearing it from me. It's really weird the kind of charge that I have, how they did it. Now that I know of bread, no law, a little bit of law, commission of a felony, meaning I had to be committing a felony to get second-degree felony murder.
Yep.
Well, in reality, if I'm be honest with you, back then, high-speed chase is loot. It was called looting, and it's a misdemeanor. They said I was in commission of a felony because I was had a probation violation and I was a fugitive from justice. But I'm still not in commission of a felony, though.
Would the drug possession be a felony?
But I didn't get a drug possession. I was on probation. I was on probation for that. I didn't get caught with nothing, Jack. They didn't find nothing in my car.
The husband has said there was a gun. She's not saying there's a gun. You're obviously surmising that he was terrified and jumped out of the car and sort of left his wife to deal with it. And then suddenly went, oh, shit, I look a bit bad here. So I'm going to say he had a gun, which is why I jumped out. And then obviously the prosecutor's run with that and gone, great. So if you're saying he had a gun, then that means we can charge him with felony murder.
Then they can charge him with felony murder.
No one else said you had a gun.
Hey, Jack. Hey, you can put me in a lecture chair. I sign the papers. On the day that it happened, Jack, nobody else said I had a gun. The two police officers, the Kansas City, Missouri Police Department, one of the most crookedest police department in the world. Listen, man, this man, Eric Eberhardt, James Ruggler, who chased me on foot, they said, oh, he's out the country. He can't testify, Your Honor. He's out the country. Now, watch this. Why on the day that it happened? You're a police officer, Jack. Watch this. I'm just hypothetical speaking. You're a police officer.
Yeah.
He said on the stand, this is where he incriminated himself. On the stand, the prosecutor asked him, what do you watch for when a criminal is committing a crime? You know what he said? We watch for hands and body language. The main thing we watch for is hands. Hey, Jack, why in his field report, why in his police statement, why in his videotape statement on the day that it happened, he didn't say I had, why he didn't say Gerald Johnson had a gun that day? Why did he wait a year later and come back to trial and say I had a gun, Jack, the police officer? Why did he wait a year later to say, a year later, Jack? Jack, I'm guilty of, Jack, listen to me. I ran from the police, big dog. I was scared. I had drugs on me. I ran. I took an innocent woman's life. It ain't a day that I don't get up and reflect back on that, Jack. I came to prison and changed my life around. But these people, the Kansas City was... Why on the day that it happened, Jack? Who does this? The day that it happened, Jack? Then near one of the police officers... I got their statements. You want me to send them to you? Give me your address. Give me your address, Jack. You can have it. I can see the whole file.
So let's take a look at what Gerald is talking about, because he did indeed send me the paperwork. It was the video statements made from the witnesses and the police officers that day, as well as trial transcripts from those same witnesses. And we'll start with Eric Eberhardt. He was the police officer who was driving the patrol car that day, the one who Gerald says initially mentions nothing to do with a gun, yet when it comes to the trial, he has seen the weapon in which Gerald was supposed to have been holding. We'll start with the videotaped statement from that day.
We observed the driver of the grey Buick get out, climb out of the driver's side window, and at which time he fell to the ground, and he got back up and attempted to flee on foot going southbound. At which time I drove around the accident and tried to head off the suspect, and my partner got out of the vehicle. And by the time I turned my vehicle around, I was able to get to where the suspect was. He was already in another blue small four-door vehicle, which belonged to someone who was stopped at the intersection and were heading westbound on 55th. At which time he got into that vehicle and fled in that vehicle northbound on Troost.
There is more questions about speed and about procedural things, which we'll skip over, and we'll go straight to where the officer is now talking about seeing Gerald exit the vehicle.
You indicated you saw this suspect exit the driver's side door of his vehicle. Yes, sir. Can you, to your recollection, can you describe to me what he was wearing at the time? It appeared that he had on a black or a dark coloured jacket or sweatshirt of some sort, a black or dark coloured skull cap, partially on the top of his head, and some dark coloured pants with, it appeared to be, a light coloured shirt. Earlier, you indicated that your partner then exited your patrol vehicle at that time. Can you indicate the officer's name? Officer Regular, James Regular. And what did he do when he exited your car? He attempted to pursue the suspect on foot at the same time. He was attempting to try to check on the individual that was in the vehicle that had gotten struck. Then, can you indicate to me what you did while your partner's out running? Earlier, you indicated that you actually passed the accident and turned back around. Yes. Then what did you do? I made a U-turn and then attempted to go. My partner was given instructions over the radio that he was fleeing eastbound on 55th. Were you able to get a very close description of this party? Were you able to see him by his face? Yes, I did.
He then goes on to talk about the preceding chase of him with Gerald, and they wrap up this statement. This officer is not asked about a gun, nor does he mention a gun in his first statement.
Why he didn't say Gerald Johnson had a gun that day? Why did he wait a year later and come back to trial and say I had a gun, Jack, the police officer? Why did he wait a year later to say a year later, Jack?
As Gerald states, a year later, when he is at trial, Officer Eberhardt gets on the stand, and this is the following from the trial transcripts. Okay, what did you do after you saw the crash? Well, we then reinitiated our lights to attend to the accident itself, because at the particular moment, we assumed that we had a serious situation on our hands. Okay, so when you got up there, what happened? When we arrived, as we began pulling up and attempting to position our vehicle so no other cars would get involved, I observed the defendant exit the vehicle through the window and attempt to run in a southbound direction on Troost. Okay, so then after the defendant got out of the driver's side window and started running southbound, what happened? My partner exited the vehicle on the passenger side and attempted to pursue on foot after him as I continued on around the accident itself and tried to cut off the suspect at the time. And at which time, he changed directions and began running in the eastbound direction on 55th. Okay, did you get a good look at him as he was running at that point? Yes. As a law enforcement officer, do you have any training and experience in watching for potential danger to yourself and others? Yes. What is it you look for? Body language, individuals' actions, speech? Okay, do you look at any part of their body in particular? Yes. The hands. Why is that? Well, because if an individual is going to inflict injury upon you or act towards you normally, it's going to be reactions with the hands. Did you happen to notice this defendant's hands as he was running? Yes. And what did you notice? I noticed when he initially exited the vehicle, his hands were free, and when he came around running southbound of the vehicle, he had an object in his hand. Okay, could you see what it was? It appeared to me to be a small handgun. Okay, and could you describe what you saw as the gun? Well, it appeared to be somewhat of a small revolver in the palm of his hand, and he had it cupped as if he was trying not to lose it. So holding it not in a sense that he was had his finger on the trigger, but just like cupped in his hands. Yes. All right, was this gun less than 16 inches long? Yes, it was. So I'm going to end it there, but as we can hear, there are a few differences a year later to this police officer's statement than the statement that he made on that very day. Of course, on the stand, he talks of seeing a gun as Gerald exits the car. In his original statement, he simply says he observed the driver of the grey Buick get out, climb out of the driver's side window, and at which time he fell to the ground, he gets back up and attempted to flee on foot going southbound. He says at which time he drove around the accident itself to try and head him off, and he says his partner got out of the vehicle at that time and the suspect turned and ran the opposite direction in northbound direction on Troost. So obviously this officer's statement has become longer. There is differences from the original to the one that he's making a year later on the stand. This, of course, isn't to say what he is recounting is not the truth. But you do have to wonder why he wouldn't mention the gun in his first statement. As he says at trial, if he'd seen it when Gerald fell out of the vehicle, surely he would mention that in his original statement. And you would have to think that he would have mentioned it on the radio to his partner, who was also trying to apprehend Gerald that day.
Why didn't they say on the day it happened that I had a gun? What police officer does that, Jack? What police officer comes back a year later and say, oh, I seen a gun cupped in the palm of his hand? The only one that's honest with it was that lady Shauna Case and James Regula. Because to be honest with you, Eric Eberhardt was honest that day, but he come back a year later and said, I had a gun. Why Miss Case didn't come back a year later and say, I had a gun, Jack? The driver, she came and got on the stand and said, I told y'all, Mr. Johnson, I never seen a weapon. Come on, Jack, man. People railroaded me, bro.
So let's take a look at Miss Kate's statement from that day, as well as her testimony at trial. She, of course, was the lady who was driving the vehicle in which Gerald would carjack to get away from the scene. At approximately 11:50 hours, I made contact with Mr. and Mrs. Cates at the scene and transported them to police headquarters. I interviewed Mrs. Cates at 12:16 hours. Miss Cates stated her and her husband had left their residence and was headed to drop her husband off at work. Miss Cates stated that she was stopped at a red light and was facing westbound at 55th on Troost. Miss Cates stated a black male got out of a silver vehicle through the driver's side window and began to run southbound. The male then turned around and ran back north towards their vehicle. Miss Cates stated that the male opened her driver's side door and got into the vehicle. She states the male never said anything. Miss Cates stated that her husband then exited the vehicle from his passenger side. The male didn't say anything, and Miss Cates stated she just slid across the seat and exited on the passenger side as well. Miss Cates stated the suspect got the vehicle started and left northbound on Troost. She states the police were immediately there and her husband pointed out the direction the suspect travelled. She described the suspect as a black male, 5'9 to 5'10, 140 pounds, thin build, short hair, 19, early 20s in age. She states she never saw the suspect with a weapon and couldn't recall what clothing he had on or if he had facial hair, gold in his mouth, tattoos or earrings. Okay, now we'll look at Mrs. Cates' testimony at trial a year later. I'm going to skip most of it because it's pretty much the same, and we'll just get straight to the most important part where Miss Cates comes into contact with Gerald on that day.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
You said that you were seated in the driver's side and the defendant came in and kind of sat on your left leg. Would his back have been facing you? Yeah, pretty much so. Okay, and did you see any weapon on the defendant? No. Okay, after the car stalled, you said that he gave you a chance to get out of the driver's side. I got out of the passenger side. My husband, he was pulling on my right arm and I scooted my legs out and kind of crawled out of the passenger side of the car. Did the defendant say anything? Nothing. And I want to move on a little bit further through her testimony to this section here where she's cross-examined about seeing Gerald getting out of the car. What did you see as you were sitting at 55th Street after the accident? Did you see Mr. Johnson get out of the car? Yes, I did. He climbed out of the driver's side window. You had a clear view of him. Well, his face, yes. His face. But you didn't see what type of clothes he had on. No. When he was running, did you see him? Was his hands moving? Oh, yes, he was running. But you didn't see a weapon in his hand? No. So again, Mrs. Cates adamant that she did not see a weapon on Gerald that day.
On the day that it happened, service of the law, police officer, Kansas City, Missouri police officer, Eric Eberhard being the driver, James Regular being the passenger, gave a videotape statement, gave statements on the day that it happened, got field reports that they wrote. They never spoke of me having a gun.
So we're going to take a look at James Regular's statement. He's the police officer who was the passenger in the car that day, and he would exit the vehicle and chase Gerald on foot. Now, we only have the statement from the day because, as Gerald has already mentioned, when it came time for his trial, apparently Officer Regular was unable to testify as he was away at that time. Now, of course, I'm not going to read this entire statement because everyone pretty much agrees on how the whole incident took place. So we're going to fast forward straight to the moment of the impact and the officers chasing after Gerald.
As we are approaching, we observe the driver get out of the suspect vehicle and begin to run southbound on Troost on the west sidewalk. We went around the accident and tried to cut off the suspect as he was fleeing. Officer Eberhard remained in the car. I proceeded to get out of the car to pursue the suspect, at which time he turned around and started running back north on the sidewalk. As I ran past the vehicle that had been struck by the suspect's vehicle, I looked in to see the driver, and when I looked back, the suspect was already in the victim's car, of the carjacking. Officer Eberhard was in the process of turning around and going towards him. The car then took off northbound, again on Troost in the victim's car. Officer Eberhard pursued them and I remained at the scene and went back to the vehicle to check on the driver, at which time she appeared to be deceased. So I called for the proper superiors.
So there's a fair bit of back and forth about the speed of the car and the camera and the recording of the incident. So I'm just going to skip ahead to where the officer talks about seeing Gerald.
During this particular time, did you have an opportunity to have a close observation of the suspect? I got a fairly good look at him. I wouldn't say that I got an excellent look at him, no. Do you think you would be able to identify him again? Yes. After you saw the suspect leave with the vehicle and leave behind the two parties that had been in that car, did you have the opportunity to have a conversation with those two people? Yes. And what did they tell you? The passenger, the male in the car, stated that when the suspect jumped into the vehicle, he was holding a small revolver in his right hand. He was kind of palming it. He wasn't threatening with it and never made any verbal threats, according to the victim, but he did have a gun in his hand. And by having that gun in his hand and holding it in the direction of the two parties in the vehicle, did they indicate to you that they felt threatened by this handgun at that time? Yes. Did you notify your partner of the possibility the suspect might be armed at that time? No, I didn't. I didn't get that information from them because as soon as my partner went off in the vehicle, I went back to check on the driver of the vehicle that had been struck. I did not talk to the victims of the carjacking until after my partner had disengaged his pursuit of the car.
So Officer Regular says that the passenger, this is Mr. Cates, had seen a small gun, however, the officer had not.
The first person that brought out the gun, that brought up the gun was a passenger, which is Daniel Cates, which was a passenger of the car. I didn't enter on his side, Jack.
Yeah.
Jack, I didn't open his door.
So Mr. Cates, he would be the first person to bring up this weapon. He would be the very first to say that Gerald had a small gun in his hand. We're going to take a look at his statement from that day, and then we'll take a look at his statement during the trial as well. And of course, yet again, I'm going to skip through all of what I deem to be unnecessary because we're just repeating ourselves and go straight to the moment of impact.
Mr. Cates, can you describe the suspect's vehicle? Well, he came basically out of nowhere, but I know he had a silver Chevy. Okay. Oh, actually, maybe a Monte Carlo or a Caprice. Okay. And prior to the impact, had you seen the suspect vehicle? No. He just came out of nowhere. Okay. And prior to the impact, did you see the victim's vehicle? Just a glance. Okay, so at the point of impact, obviously that draws your attention there. Tell me what you see next. How does the suspect get out of his car? Okay, when his car's quit spinning, well, I actually thought he had gotten thrown from the car, but he apparently jumped out of the driver's window, which was broken. He then landed on the ground on his side and then proceeded to get up. And I thought he was going to go and check on the victim, but he just ran past her. So you see him running past southbound on Troost, and is he on the east or west side of the street? He was southbound on the west side of the sidewalk, running up that side. And he runs past the victim's vehicle. Yes. And he turns around and then approaches your car. And then he ran back kind of cat-cornered from... right. He would have went south. Okay, he ran kind of cat-corner back to us. Okay, and approaches the driver's side of the vehicle? Yes. Are the doors of the vehicle unlocked? Oh, yes, they were. And do you know if the windows are up or down? They were up. Okay, does he say anything at this point? No, he never said anything. Okay, if I can stop you at that point, as he's approaching the car, what did you see him doing and what did you see in the suspect's hand? So I see him fumbling with his pants, trying to stick maybe a gun. Oh, well, not maybe, but a gun he had in his hand. I don't know if he was trying to stick it back in there so he could drive, but he made it aware that I saw the gun. Okay, and when he got in the car, is this gun still out? It was still out at that point. He apparently couldn't get it back in his pants at the time, but he knew I saw it. Is he pointing it at you or is it just in his hand? No, it's in his hand. Does he say anything to you? Nope, he never said a thing. Okay, can you describe the weapon that you saw? It was maybe a small hand revolver? A darker gun. Metal. All black. Somewhere right in there. Maybe a 38 or something. It was a smaller sort of snub nose. Small enough to fit in the palm of his hand. The palm of his hand, okay. So he is in the vehicle, you see the gun, he's not saying anything. Do you say anything at this point? Yes, just let us go, please, you can take the car. I said that about two or three times, and then finally I just opened, he wasn't responding, so I opened the door and we got out.
So that is his statement from just a few hours after this had taken place. Now, I don't want to start picking heaps of holes in somebody's statement from a carjacking. It's a stressful situation. It's not a nice thing to have to go through. But it does appear to me that he kind of catches himself in certain spots when he's talking about the gun. So, for instance, he says, I seen him fumbling with his pants, trying to stick maybe a gun. And then he corrects himself and says, well, not maybe, but a gun. And again here. But he made it aware that I saw the gun. And then the description of the gun. It was a smaller, maybe a small hand revolver, darker gun, metal or black, somewhere right there, maybe a 38 or something. It was a smaller snub nose, small enough to fit in the palm of his hand. So not exactly a solid description of the gun, but again, pointing out the fact that this man has been through a highly stressful situation. So that is the video statement from just a few hours after this crime had taken place. So we're going to fast forward now a year later to the trial of Gerald Johnson and Mr. Kate's testimony on stand. Now, on the silver car, did you see anyone get out of the car after the crash? Yeah, actually, I saw a man. I thought he was thrown out of the car, but I guess, apparently, he was jumping out and fell on his back as he came out of the vehicle. And what did he do after he fell down? Well, he got up and messed with his pants like this, sort of pulled them up and took off running up the street, heading southbound on Troost now. It would be south because he knocked the car on up from the intersection. All right, you said that he was messing with the waistband of his pants. Did you see anything at that point? Well, it appeared to be a handgun. All right, a smaller handgun at that time. Okay, and did you see the weapon in his hands or in his pants? Or can you describe what you saw? I saw it. Well, I saw it more or less. He had fallen out of the car on his back and it had fallen off to the side of his pants. And he was adjusting it right so that he could run with it. All right. So was it in his hand at that time? No. It was in his waistband. Right. Okay. And could you describe the gun that you saw? Well, from a distance from about me to you, it looked... apparently looked to be a brushed aluminium or brushed poly. It wasn't a chrome gun, it was metal. It was a metal gun with a black hand grip. You said then he started running southbound. What happened after he started running southbound? Well, he came up to a dead stop and start back towards us. Then what happened? As he came up towards us, he was messing, pulling up his pants like this. I knew that he had a weapon. I wasn't going to question that, but I thought he was going to keep running by us. I looked up and out of the front windshield and I couldn't see anything. And then I turned back and he was already had his leg over my wife, getting underneath her, you know, getting, well, not underneath her, but right across her like that, trying to take off in her car. And we're going to fast forward now to the cross-examination of Mr. Cates and again, talking about the gun. When did you see a weapon in his hand? Or when he first got out of the vehicle? When he first landed on his back, he was messing with it, okay? And he was trying to adjust it as he was running back down Troost because I thought he was going to keep heading north as to Troost. You say this was a darker gun? No, darker handle. Dark handle. Black in colour? Yes, that's right. So this time, Mr. Cates does seem to be more confident about his description of the gun, this time describing it as brushed aluminium or brushed poly. It wasn't a chrome gun. It was a metal gun with a black handle grip. So again, a lot more confident about what this gun looked at a year later as opposed to just after the incident. Did your attorney come to you with a plea deal at any stage or was this straight to trial?
Yeah, they did. Yeah, they did. They came to me with a deal. They tried to offer me 20, Jack, but here's the deal. I'm going to tell you why they take the 20. Guess why I didn't take the 20, Jack? Because I ain't had no gun. Listen, if they came to me and said, we're dropping the gun charges, we're going to leave you with the involuntary manslaughter for the car accident, and I'm going to take that. I'll say I'm guilty of that. But I ain't taking none that I ain't did. I ain't had no gun, Jack, and it's right there in black and white. And if anybody really took my case and really combed through it page for page and really paid attention, they'd say, yo, man, they ran amok on this kid, man, because that's what they did to me. I'm not accepting the gun charge. I'm not accepting nobody trying to come and talk to me and say, well, listen, we want to give you a sentence reduction. Nah. I want society to know. The same way they talk bad about a criminal, the news people and the prosecutors, how they chump up the charges on people to make themselves look good, to get a badge of honor, to make their chest be poked out. I want them to feel the same way when the real truth come out of saying, yes, I did do that to him. Because black and white speaks for itself. Statements speak for itself. That's why they got recanting the statement. That's why they got, oh, he wanted to do an affidavit. That's why they got all those things. But what about the victims? The victims matter. Victims mean leaving someone no choice in the matter. That's what a victim is, Jack. I understand I took victims. I understand that now. And I took a class called ICVC, which is Impact of Victims Crime class, where the victims come in and you be able to talk to the victims. And I done took that class over 30 times, Jack. And now I'm a facilitator in them class. I facilitate them classes as well. But what I say that because a victim, Marianne from Missouri mentioned, she sat down and told me one time, she said, I told her about my case, and she said, you know what, Gerald? You know, my daughter's been missing since 2003, and I haven't found her. And she said, it's sad how people do people. She said, them people didn't have to lie on you like that. They could have just told the truth and everything, let the system work its course. But you know, it wasn't so much just them, Jack. It wasn't just the victim. It was the system that was getting the victims to lie. That's sad, man. You want to coerce somebody to say something that's false. Why do people like that, Jack? Why do us like that, man? Because I come from a neighborhood where my mother was strung out on drugs and my father was a drug dealer and I grew up in foster care system. Or what about when they was molesting me? I don't want to talk about that. What about when the pain was there when I was a child where I couldn't even be a child because I had to be a grown man at the age of 10, 11, 12, 13, 14? Yeah, you right. I was affiliated with the Bloods, Jack. You know why I was affiliated with them? Because they made me feel safe. Facts. They made me feel like I was wanted. They didn't give up on me. So all them articles that people write about a person, whether they writing it about me, whether they writing it about other people, is it fair when them people ain't really got to sit down and know them? You going off some documents, you going off some paperwork because a person did a crime that you didn't like that they did. So you know what? Let's go listen to everybody that got something to say negative about them. We don't want to know the positive. Did they tell you about when I saved the lady life? When a transgender was robbing her down on Truce, I can go get the family to talk to you about it. I say they found their grandmother's life early in the morning. I'm just happened to be out there early one morning, Jack, and some people just trying to rob this poor old lady that's getting on the bus going to work. 4 o'clock in the morning, Jack. I was there and saved her life. And I wasn't even looking for the accolades, big dog. She had a barbecue one day, and I happened to be outside. She said, hey, little boy, you come over here and get your tray for what you did. I said, no, ma'am, thank you, though. You know what, you where I'm at right now with them right now, Jack? I'm still part of their family. You know why? Because I'm married to her granddaughter. I married her granddaughter. I got a 25-year-old child, her granddaughter, Jack. And I ain't had no gun. But I sent it here. I changed my life around for me.
So, listening to all of this, I'm sure there's people going, so what? If he had a gun or not, he still hit a lady in a car and ran off, and she died. As a result of his actions, an innocent woman passed away that day. A woman who doesn't get a second chance. On that day, Ida Taylor lost her life, and a family lost a loved one. So, Gerald, you made your bed, you lie in it. You know, if you had not run away from the police that day, if you'd just taken your punishment because you had the drugs, a lady would still be alive.
Right.
You know, this lady was killed because you crashed into the car and then you ran away.
Now, Jack, it ain't a day that I don't get up with the mindset of I got to make today better than it was yesterday. Society's gonna have their belief about us guys in here. They're going to look at us as criminal. And it's one thing I learned is in critical thinking skills and criminal thinking skills. They say, once a criminal, always a criminal. I'm just a criminal that's responsible now. Because it ain't a day to, if I get out tomorrow or if I get out 20 years from now. If the police was ever to pull me over again when they run me, guess what it's going to say? My history. So that's going to be there. However, the responsibility of the man now and at that moment, as he's taking the steps to strive better for each and every day to do better, that's what matters. Because what's done is already done and you can't take it back. So we had to be able to either give a person a second chance or say, you know what, let's throw away the key. But what does that even change when it comes to us? Even you people, the guys that got life without, you giving a person life without, what does that change about helping that person to do better? Once that person starts doing better and changes life around, how do y'all know? How does the society know?
I guess what we have to think about with this particular case is, like any of the cases, I suppose, whether we think Gerald is telling the truth. Let's say he is telling the truth. Let's entertain that fact for a moment. Let's entertain the fact that he didn't have a gun that day. However, one witness would say he did. Now, let's say the officers didn't see that gun that day. Neither of them said in their initial statements that they saw a gun. Let's say that they didn't see a gun on that day. But the prosecutor says, well, look, the witness is saying that there was a gun. This is a bad guy. This is a guy who killed a woman, an innocent woman. And if all we hit him with is a manslaughter charge, he will likely be out in just 7 years. But if he has a gun, we can take him off the streets for good. Are we okay with that? Again, Gerald says he's a changed man. He says he wants a second chance to do better with his life. The question is, does he deserve one? Do you think that if you had just got the sentence based on involuntary manslaughter of it, what's it, 7 years on that particular charge?
Right. The max was 7 years.
Yeah. Do you think if you just got that 7 years, do you think you would have come out changed, or do you think you would have left after that 7 years and gone back to crime?
You know what, Jack? You know what? To be honest with you, I can't say what I would have did then. But I will say this, though. I can never put a time on something that I destroyed. I destroyed a community. You know, Miss Taylor losing her life due to the stupidity that I chose to run from the police that morning when I could have just pulled up and gave them the drugs, went to jail, and been back home by now. Now, I'll be 46 years old Friday, Jack. I was born November 10, 1977, and I still got my health, and I'm thankful for that. And if it was one thing that I can do, if I told you it was one thing I could do, and that is to be able to tell Mrs. Taylor's daughter that I apologize for that day that happened. And I wish that I can also apologized to Shauna Cates and Daniel Cates. And even though he said what he said about me having a gun and I never had a gun, I still would apologize to them for the simple fact they still was a victim and I took them victim. I feel like being heard and having an understanding of, hey, this guy made a mistake. Is life plus 15 years warranted for what he did? I can't say that. Only God knows. But I can say that the system, the justice system, how they treated me was unfair. They didn't treat me fair, Jack. And I can say that now as a man, and I'm saying that with all honesty to you. And
it ain't a day that, left.
It ain't a day that I don't get up and reflect back on the crime that happened. And I humbly apologize for it, and I just ask that society, you know, really look into it. If you're going to look into it, really look into it and draw the conclusion is just the right conclusion.
You have 1 minute remaining.
This is the story of Gerald Johnston so far. And of course, we'll stay in touch with Gerald as he looks to try and find himself an attorney to help him take his case back to court. Coming up in our next episode, there's a gentleman with an attorney. In fact, not just any old attorney. He has the might of the California Innocence Clinic on his side.
My name is Raimundo Chigoya. I was sentenced for first-degree murder. They gave me 50 years to life. I've been incarcerated now for 25 years.
On January 10th, the year 2000, an 18-year-old Raimundo Chigoya says that he was at home watching The Simpsons and recovering from the flu. Meanwhile, at a place called the Stardust Motel in Riverside, California, Billy Medlin was standing by the soda machine helping a fellow resident get a drink. A man approaches him, yells, then shoots and kills him. Prosecutors would say the man who committed that murder was Raimundo Chigoya. He says he is innocent of this crime. And the California Innocence Clinic believes him.
He was on a path to succeed and they went after him.
Next time on 1 Minute Remaining. 1 Minute Remaining is a Mashed Pumpkin production created, hosted and produced by Jack Lawrence. Audio and sound design by Jack Lawrence and Dom Evans of Earsay.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.